Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. On this week's show, comedy writer Betsy Bornes is here to talk about the underrepresentation of women in TV writing. Yanis Varoufakis, the now former Greek finance minister and a LARB contributor, has had some very provocative things to say in the wake of the Greek meltdown. Tom and I will be discussing his ideas. We'll be doing a segment we like to call What Are You Reading? With our friend Dinah Lenny. And our good friend Mark Haskell Smith is here to talk about his new book about nudity, Naked at Lunch.
Best titles ever, this guy.
He's incredible with titles.
Best buns, too. That's why he did the book.
Oh! I am here with the professor, Tom Lutz.
You're not going to say nice buns, Lori?
I don't think I have to.
And queen of ad-libs, Lori Weiner.
Entschuldigen, bitte.
Hey, guys. We are joined today by my friend Betsy Bornes. Betsy, thanks for coming on the LARB Radio Hour.
So, you know, everybody talks about the underrepresentation of women on writing staffs, on TV show staffs. How have you experienced that problem?
Well, when I started on Roseanne, you were usually the only woman on staff, or there would be a couple of women, and Roseanne, as an angry feminist, said, screw you. I'm going to have 50 writers and two will be women. And,
that was a large advance.
Exactly.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
But she actually did get a lot more women than I saw on other shows. But generally, you're the minority. It's how a lot of my African-American friends feel working at Fortune 500 companies. You know, it's like, hey, you're the black guy in the room, but there's no other black guy in the room. And, you know, we've come so far, and yet, why am I the only one here?
That's as far as we can go. Sorry. Right. We did like, something, and that's all we're
it's
doing.
It's like there's no glass ceiling. Now clean the glass ceiling. That's what it's like. There's some. That's how it feels to me. Yeah. But now I think I'd heard that things had changed a lot. I mean, my last staff, I can't say because it was a primarily African-American show. And as my husband says, I converted to being an angry black man. I was so angry at the lack of African Americans hired on sitcom staffs that I just said, I'm not hiring any white people because the most talented people aren't working. But no, it's still very much like that. I think it's because the whole point of being in a room is hangability. And so the majority of the room wants to be able to say things that no one will get angry at. And if the majority of the room is men, then they're always going to want to keep that as the majority.
That's true. But I remember when I fell in love with Breaking Bad, I noticed right away that there were a lot of women listed on the credits, you know, as director, producer, and, you know, two of the seven were writers. And then I interviewed them. And the women actually wrote some of the most horrifically violent scenes in the show. And, you know, which is just great because it's always like you have these assumptions about what people are
right.
going to do well. And they'll always surprise
That's
you.
That's true. I still have people always assume women are good with story and not joke people. And I don't know if you experienced that, Seth. At Roseanne, people were sort of shocked that, wow, you're horrible with story, but you have the most wonderfully vulgar jokes. I would pride myself on being hard-edged comedy for that reason. And I mean, obviously, being able to tell a story is a very important part. And I think as a woman, it's assumed you do that naturally because you have empathy. But I think women are just as funny as men, have just as much edge.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Regarding the sitcom staffs, I think guys, I've been in rooms where guys who really can only do jokes are hired. They can't write.
Right.
But they're funny and they can do jokes. Women never, women like that and they exist, I don't think get hired.
Right.
Really, at least, you know, when I was doing it, right?
Boy, is that true.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
It's probably still the case. I haven't been in a sitcom room in a while, but
right.
I'm betting it's still the case.
Or drama. I know a lot of women have gone over to drama.
Well, drama seems so welcoming to women because you look around at what's going on. I mean, starting with Shonda Rhimes.
Right.
But Jenji Cohen with Orange is the New Black and Jill Soloway with that show, which is, you know, they say it's a comedy.
Right.
It's really sort of a drama. You know, what's the name of that show?
Transparent.
Transparent.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which I think, the humor, I love the humor in it.
It's great.
I got that. I did a drama last year. And women I know who are comedy writers who had done drama said, oh, you're going to love it. It's great. And I just was walking around sort of like lifting up rocks going, where are the jokes? Where's all the funny? Wait a minute. It's like that scene works, but it should be funny. But it just, I miss that. Hmm. And I think it's just an aesthetic choice. I can't live in a world without jokes.
No, for me, the best dramas are the ones with the jokes.
Right. I mean,
that's what made Breaking Bad so good and The Sopranos so good.
Right, true.
Breaking Bad was so funny. I always felt like you could hear the writers laughing in Burbank, you know, when something terrible would happen. Like there was, for some reason, it was funny, terrible, always. But with the men-women thing, like for instance, with this show, sometimes I find myself
this show
in
the Amy Schumer show.
No, this show that we're doing right here, right
the
now,
show,
in reality,
this is, this
in
the
we're not doing the Amy Schumer show.
Is,
wait, my agent is going to get quite a call from me. Wait, I'm sitting here with a Jewish guy, and who are these? What?
No, there. But oftentimes, like they'll get going, and I'm like, well, this is really interesting. I'm just going to listen to this because this really is who I am. I like to like hang back and listen.
Right.
And then I'm like, oh yeah, I'm on the show. I have to say something. And that happens. And
That happened to Lucille Ball. That's when the Ricky stories happened, is she was being Lucy. And then, oh, he's so interesting with his Cuban thing. Oh, I'm in the show.
That's a joke.
If it makes
yes,
you feel
that
like,
is a joke. Okay.
If it makes you feel any better, the same thing happens to me.
Yeah?
I hang back and think, oh, yeah, I better say something.
Oh. Yeah, no, it's, but show. if you're truly entertained, I mean, that's the great thing.
No,
if
exactly.
you're in a great comedy room or a great room anywhere, the minute I don't feel compelled to say anything is the minute I'm having a good time. Because I'm hearing some interesting stuff.
Yeah.
At certain points, you obviously have to fight that and get back into the
yes,
tussle.
Yes. That's right? the again, as a woman, and I think a lot of, getting back to Amy Schumer, a lot of her stuff, I'm sure, comes from being a woman, a female comic who hangs out with guy comics. Mm. And when I was writing my book, I hung out with a lot of guy comics for years. And I just remember watching male and female comics and thinking, they're almost equal on stage, but when they go off stage and it's actually the personalities at work, the women would be pushed into an invisibility corner, kind of. And it's just a different dynamic. And I think with Amy, she must have, I'm assuming, she experienced that and fought against it. And that's what comes through to me in her act, is there's an imaginary group of male comics standing around her on stage, but she's shouting the loudest and you're hearing her jokes. Talk about self-referential. That might just be me. I don't know if everyone else sees 10 comedians around Amy Schumer on stage, but that's how I feel.
That works.
She's shouting the loudest, and I used to get that from Roseanne, who spoke so loudly, but it was because she literally had to talk over everyone else who was telling jokes in clubs.
Well, I remember hearing Tina Fey being interviewed, and she said that she knew something was changing at this one moment in a rehearsal of a Saturday Night Live where Amy Poehler was trying a new character, and one of the male writers said, no, that's not working. I don't find that funny. And Amy Poehler said, I don't give a fuck what you find funny.
Oh, that's...
And Tina Fey was like, wow, I have not heard that before.
Right.
That something is changing. That is interesting.
That was Jimmy Fallon. Seriously,
that,
not,
serious?
Not a joke. Yeah, that was Jimmy Fallon who did that.
That is, because I started out working at Saturday Night Live as an assistant. And I could so imagine a woman saying, I could imagine me having said, well, I don't find that funny, and absolutely nothing. Like, literally, can I have another cup of coffee, hon? Good for Jimmy Fallon that he got I don't fucking care. Because what I would get is, honey, can you give me that cream? I felt that my opinion was more transparent than cellophane. It was like see-through of see-through.
Mm, interesting.
But there were a couple women writers there then.
Mm-hmm. Lots of women have had hard times,
right.
Including Sarah Silverman on that show.
When I was doing my book, I interviewed some women who were writers on Saturday Night Live who told me, and I just, of course, I had been an assistant, so I was just looking at them like, yeah, but you get called a writer. I would do anything to be a writer who's shit upon. I'm just an assistant.
Betsy, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7. Earlier this week, Tom, the Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, who was also, as you know, a LARB contributor, resigned. He's maintained that the entire economic system is unsustainable. It's all a house of cards, he claims. He ties the beginning of this calamity to the Nixon administration uncoupling the dollar from the gold standard in order to preserve American hegemony. Is he right?
Well, let's move forward a little bit. The thing he wrote for us, called Vicious Disequilibrium, was about the Great Crash of 2008. And for Varoufakis and for a number of other European economists and for some of our own economists, like Paul Krugman, the problem of the reorganization of the world economy and the relationship between that reorganization and calls for austerity, those calls are themselves part of the power of global capital to wreak its havoc. And if they're not solutions to the problem, they are just kind of ongoing symptoms of the problem. So for Varoufakis, this moment in Greece is a moment in which the people, actual people, are standing up against a global capital system that is trying to force them to do X, Y, and Z, and instead saying, no, actually, we want the global economic system to work for us, not the other way around.
He sees this in very grand terms. What was it that he said?
On his website, right after he resigned, he said that the referendum of the 5th of July will remain in history as a unique moment when a small European nation rose up against debt bondage.
What are the ramifications here, really? We were talking earlier about whether the question is whether or not this is a bee sting or a staph infection. He clearly thinks it's a staph infection. What do you think?
Well, I think that when Paul Volcker, who then became the head of the Fed, right, but at that time was Nixon's Treasury Secretary, mm-hmm. I believe, you know, he said that this is part of a plan that includes the disintegration of the global economic system. There is a school of economic thought that says that, and Naomi Klein writes about this in The Shock Doctrine, right? That allowing countries, allowing economies to crumble, fall, crash, burn, enter into extreme poverty and distress is good for the global economic flow, right? So from Varoufakis's position and Pictet, the French mm-hmm. Economist,
his book Capital,
which was a bestseller. For them, obviously, the big banks, the big global banks, love the idea of the small Greek banks failing. Once they fail, once they crumble into dust, that's a bunch of banking business that now is going to be part of Citibank and Deutsche Bank and the other big global banks can pick up.
Now, on KPFK, it's natural to just say that the domination of the banks in that situation is a terrible thing, prima facie. But if the end result is that the world is more economically intertwined, why is that a bad thing?
Well, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, the world is globally intertwined. That's a fact. But if you think about people sitting in a little Greek village, eating the fish they pulled out of the ocean and the feta that they made in their back room and the olives that they pulled off their own trees and, you know, all doused in the superb olive oil that they got squashed at the local, right? That there's ways in which every moment of every life does not need to be dominated by the desire to sell us more electronic goods, right? That is, there's no reason why every moment of every life needs to be part of a global economic system. The idea that some local economic activity, local pre-economic activity, should survive the global banking system, it's not just some kind of weird hippie dream. It's the reality for a lot of people on the planet. And it's not a terrible thing if not everybody on the planet gets sucked into, you know, when he calls it debt bondage, it's debt bondage, but it's also bondage to economic decisions that are being made in Brussels and Washington rather than economic decisions that are being made in somebody's living room.
So either way, they'll be in debt and it's really a question of degree.
Well, yeah.
They're not going to not be in debt if they withdraw from the euro and they need to get money somewhere to pay their pensions and their government salaries and the things they've obligated themselves to pay.
Debt. Everybody's in debt. I'm in debt. Aren't you in debt?
I am in debt.
Of course we're in debt. And the U.S. is in debt. And the European community is in debt, right? The debt is part of the way economic systems work in the world that we're in. So the idea that somebody's going to decide how much debt is too much debt, and that decision is going to be made in some central place based on the most powerful people in the room's decisions about how much debt is too much debt, Paul Krugman's been writing about this in relation to the U.S. economy for decades and decades, right? This kind of austerity thinking, this kind of small government thinking is all fine and good unless you're the person whose diabetes needs to get treated and you don't have the money. Debt is absolutely fungible. I'm writing to Yanis Varoufakis to ask him to do a kind of recap now for us. He wrote for us just before he took on the job as finance minister, and I'm hoping he'll write for us on the way out.
We look forward to that. Our friend, the author, memoirist Dinah Lenny is here to answer the question, what have you been reading lately?
What I've been reading lately is this book called H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. Did you guys know about this book?
Yeah.
It's everywhere right now, and deservedly so. It's really a magnificent book. Helen MacDonald is English, and in the wake of her father's death, in her terrible grief, buys a goshawk.
Her father was a falconer.
Her father was not a falconer. Her father was a photographer, but she has this relationship since she was a child. She's been in love with birds and in love with the idea of falconry, and she's trained birds before. She's an experienced falconer. So she gets this bird, and she also, at the same time, while she's grieving for her father and training this bird, and it's very, very difficult to train the bird, she's also reading T.H. White's book, which is called The Goshawk. And he did it all wrong, and he was training a bird for his own reasons. Much of this is about a struggle with wildness, really, with wilderness, the struggle between species, the struggle for one species to understand another, and issues of dominance. And because the birds kill, because that's what they do, they're all about death, she says, and it's her job to keep this bird fed, she's killing. She's killing for the bird. The other thing is that this sport of falconry is class-based in England, and so there's much discussion of class in the book. She's not someone who comes from a sort of elitist background, but she's dealing with the question of class, control, domination, and grief. Coming to terms with grief, which is perhaps the wildest state of all, I think.
That's
and
amazing.
That's what she's trying to do.
Incredible.
It is an incredible book.
Does she come to love the bird? Is it that
she
kind of
She absolutely does come to love the bird. And one of the questions in the book for me is, does the bird love her? What is love? How do we love? How do we return love? And, you know, this is the stuff she's dealing with constantly. She loves the bird. The bird's name is Mabel. And the bird sounds wonderful. The other thing I want to say about this book is that not only is it beautifully composed and orchestrated, just in terms of the structure of the book and the way she's weaving these various themes and this material, it's also so beautifully written. She uses language in ways that are surprising and delightful, and she makes you laugh because in her descriptions of the bird and her relationship with the bird, and then in the next moment, you're really crying. I mean, it's really a gorgeously written book.
A few years ago, Rebecca O'Connor wrote a memoir called Lift, which is about her falconry, and she got a peregrine falcon. And as you read the memoir, she starts talking about her child abuse. And it starts to become very clear that her relationship with the bird has something to do with this kind of trying to work through this relationship to a father who had abused her.
Uh-huh.
And the bird, it's a killer, right?
Exactly. They're killers.
They're killers, and they're kind of unfeeling, and you're doing things, you're trying to please them, and you're trying to be good to them, and they are ready to hurt you and fly away.
Absolutely.
At any second.
Absolutely. Right? So there's that.
Yeah, and H is for Hawk is following some of that same territory.
Yeah, and she says, you know, there's a place where she says, I'm the person that, you know, doesn't want to kill a spider. And here I am breaking the necks of rabbits for my bird. The thing that's different, I think, is that she isn't working out a relationship with her father. She really did adore her father more than she loved him more than she loved anybody. And they were really simpatico. So for her, I would say this is more a book about control. She's also doing a beautiful job of sort of sussing out who T.H. White was and what his various...
The guy who wrote The Once and Future King.
Exactly.
Right.
But, you know, a homosexual at a time when it wasn't easy, living in England.
Fantastic.
Sounds amazing.
It's amazing.
The book is H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7. Mark Haskell Smith is with us today. Our friend Mark Haskell Smith, the author of Naked at Lunch, A Reluctant Nudist's Adventures in the Clothing Optional World. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what I want to know is, people hear the word nudism and they think 100 different things, but what I'm getting from reading the book is that nudism is actually a philosophy. It's not just running around with your clothes off.
Yeah, it's a philosophy that's been around for a couple hundred years. Well, in Europe, it's more like, you know, vegetarianism, being athletic, getting outside, living a healthy lifestyle, and being naked is just part of it. It connects you to nature, they feel. And here in the States, it's about being naked and sitting around and barbecuing things and drinking beer.
A detail that you had told me early on before you wrote the book, which is that a nudist always carries a towel. So we were talking about why, because everyone had a kind of slightly different interpretation. Two of the main interpretations were, one, from a man to hide an erection, and because people are always leaking.
It's hygiene. It's just more hygienic, keeps your secretions from getting on the furniture, is the main one. I mean, if you do happen to get an erection, a towel is a handy thing to cover up, because if you sport wood a little too openly, you'll be asked to leave most of those resorts and clubs.
You have a rack for your towel at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the rules are pretty clear that you either jump in the pool and cool off, or roll over, or put a towel on it.
Did you have any experience in the world of nudism?
No, not really. I had skinny dipped with friends at a quarry in Kansas when we were in high school, and that was about the extent of it.
So did you bring any expectations to it?
You know, I'm not a very particularly judgmental person anyway, but I try to go without any expectations. I'm just like walking into these situations and let's just see what happens.
You do have a great tone for that, both in the cannabis book and in this book, in that you don't come off as judgmental. But yet, we still see that as funny. And that, I think that's very hard to do. Are there any writers who do that were models for you? Like a kind of, Evelyn Well or A.J. Liebling or something like that?
Yeah, there's like J. Martin Troost, who wrote these books about living in like Fiji and Vanuatu. Really, really funny books but he's the butt of the joke. I think Bill Bryson does that really well. I think Bill Buford does it to a degree. Jeff Dyer, I think, does it to a large degree. It's kind of a nice way to get into these worlds and get people to open up when you're like the buffoon. You walk in and go, hey, what? Why do you do that?
Why do we have no clothes on?
Right. And, you know, nudists, much actually like cannabis growers, no one has ever really asked that question, so they can't wait to tell you. I mean, people talked for hours and hours and hours about why they did it and what they thought about it and how it changed their life or how it liberated them from cosmetic fashion, industrial complex. And
did you develop kind of a unified field theory of nudism, why people were doing it? Did you find one overriding principle?
No, surprisingly, it's really different for everyone. For a lot of women, it's about body acceptance. They don't look like the fashion model. They don't look like a movie star. But when they're naked with other naked people, they seem to be accepted for just who they are. And
occasionally, I'm sure there must be a very sexy, beautiful woman with a gorgeous figure. That happens, I assume.
Yeah.
I mean, is there any hostility toward her or anything
like that? No. Mm-hmm. Not that I ever noticed. I mean, there was, you know, a couple times in France, there were some like really, really beautiful people walking around. And there was one time when I was watching this pétanque game, these older men were playing, and this woman walked by and literally the ball froze in the air and all these cigarettes started dangling off their lips and they just like, time stopped as she walked past. And then it was like, all boom, blah, blah, and then they're back on the game. You know? And it also in Spain, I think I mentioned this one in the book, there were these two Russian couples. They're drinking champagne and at breakfast and they're wearing like amazing clothes and they were like movie stars. And then it was the only time my whole research for 2 years where I was like, I can't wait to see these people naked. And I have to say, they did not disappoint. Mm-hmm. They were gorgeous, the men and the women.
Mm-hmm. Back to the towel for just one moment. I'm not done with that. How big a towel are we talking about?
Oh, you all different kinds.
Some people take, all different sizes.
Yeah, beach towels or like smaller towels. You could have a discreet towel in your purse, you know?
Oh, okay. So you can carry a purse, but you wear clothes, but you're carrying a purse.
Well, yeah. Like at the nudist town in France, where it's like 60,000 people, everyone's naked. There's like a bunch of supermarkets and pâtisseries and wine stores. And so you carry a little tote bag with your stuff and... You know.
Now, Mark, before we move off that, you said very casually, the nudist town in France. Let's, right. let's back up a little bit. What nudist town in France?
It's called Cap d'Agde. It's in the south of France. And it is actually probably the most famous nudist resort in the world. And it's got, it's basically you enter at a checkpoint and it's got like minimum security prison fences all around it to keep out paparazzi mostly because they had started having a real problem with it about 20 years ago. And it's like you rent an apartment and there's people who live there all the time. There's people who come and go for their holidays, but it's right on the beach and it's a full town, like supermarkets, nightclubs, restaurants, bars. There's even a dry cleaner there.
What was the first time you participated like? Walk us through that.
That was at the Desert Sun Resort in Palm Springs. And it was actually really hard to get a reservation at these places because they don't like single men to come, you know. And my wife was like, no way. So I finally got a reservation at this place and I went. And, you know, you get there and they, you know, you get your room key and you, I had to walk past the pool. It was like, I don't know, like 20 or 30 naked, basically retirees at this place and some other people. And so I got in the room and then I basically... took off my clothes and then started applying sunscreen and then would head for the door and go, you know, I might have missed a spot. And I go back and I put on some more sunscreen. So basically for 2 hours, I would look in the mirror and go, oh, more sunscreen. Because I just didn't want to go out. And finally, when I did finally go out, I would look freshly turtle waxed and was quite shiny. And people did look at me and kind of looked away, like they winced in horror. And I thought, and I wonder, I was kind of like, hey, wait, I'm young and relatively fit compared to most of you. And they're all like making these weird faces. And then I looked down and I realized my penis had become a Shang Dynasty artifact, as I say in the book. It was highly lacquered and really reflective. I didn't even know skin could get that reflective. It was like mirrored.
What turned that make you start enjoying it?
People's eyes turned away.
Yeah. No, I guess, you know, it's just that one time when you're like talking to this guy in the wine store about the local rosés of the Languedoc and, you know, and all of a sudden you just realize, oh, I'm naked, but that's doesn't matter. And
something drew you to this project. What was that? How did you get started?
I'm fascinated with about rebels and sort of, you know, outliers, outlaws, you know, particularly mm-hmm. people who do things that are quasi illegal, like cannabis growers and these underground botanists. And I was thinking, what other group is like that? And I just thought nudists, because they still get arrested. They're still closing nude beaches. They raid. And, you know, my editor actually told me this the other day, but he counted up. I wrote a 300-word book proposal that they bought.
Wow, that's pretty great.
It's kind of like, hey, what about this?
It's a sentence.
It's basically two tweets.
That's our show for this week. I would like to thank Betsy Borns, Mark Haskell Smith, Dinah Lenny, our intern Eric Webster, our producer Jerry Gorin, the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, my name is Seth Greenland. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Go to iTunes, download us there. If you feel like it, give us a rating. 5 stars would be appreciated.